your name, sir?
November 2, Sierra Victor Tango. Name here is Nick.
Okay, we got you, Nick and Glenn. Was there a third person? You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I was just listening before about the comments with the batteries and, designing many, many uninterruptible power systems over the years. One of the things with batteries are they make for very, very good instantaneous crossover power during power surges, power interruptions, and to have true uninterruptible power, you really need battery backup. To actually get a generator started, stabilized, and to try to get it to supply continuous modes of power, it actually takes them quite a bit of time. And what's interesting...
Some failed. Did we time it out, or what do you think happened, Eric?
I don't know yet. I'll find out in a minute.
In other words, you're going back to the site. Yeah. We think we waited long enough, so we don't think it's a timeout.
Well, the convo didn't last that long, about 43 seconds.
Dick, it stayed up on the 375. It crapped out on 850.
Okay, we heard the first third of your message, Eric, and the main thing that you told us was that a generator alone is nowhere near enough. When it comes to instantaneous takeover for truly uninterruptible power, it's got to be a battery. And the battery's got to hold you up for the length of time that it takes to start up a generator and stabilize it. And some generators, if they haven't been run for a couple of weeks, the starting sequence and stabilization could easily take 20, 30 seconds, and no computer can tolerate that much output time, power outage time without losing its data. So I guess there's multiple ways you can look at the problem. One is truly uninterruptible power that lasts forever. And if you've got a zillion batteries, or if that battery's backed up for the generator, maybe you can do that. Or the other approach would be to have enough battery power and/or generator timing such that you get a chance to do a slow, controlled turn down of your computers. But when you're running a massive computer system like Cantor Fitzgerald probably was, I wonder if they're willing to really turn off those computers, even in a friendly manner. What do you think, Glenn? Give your speech in 15-second increments to make sure that we're still on the air, if you know what I mean. KC2QIQ. K2RIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. My real comment there was really just when you look at ampere hours for batteries versus... And I kept that one short, Dick.
K2-1-IFY, what a comment.
Hang on, I'm finding out what it is.
I was starting to get a little paranoid there. I thought it might just be me, KC2QIQ.
It was you.
Could be.
The 375 stayed up. This one went out.
Eric, we're going to wait for you to tell us we're back in normal operation.
Well, I'll just keep it short. Seems like there's a timer inside the repeater that's going.
Yeah, I felt like I talked for at least as long as Glenn did, but I'm able to hear whether or not the machine's on the air. Who is the other person who wants to make a comment? Give me a call at it slowly.
Kill all Bravo 1, India Fox, Yankee. Now, you want to let you guys know, Glenn stayed up on the 375. On this one, he seemed to time it out.
Yep, thank you. We know that. Anyone else want to make a comment about uninterruptible power and 9/11 and World Trade Center?
Yeah, what were this is N2MB. What were the broadcasters using for backup power?
When Eric has a chance, that would be interesting for him to tell us. I'm not convinced. The total amount of energy required to run a broadcast station, 50 kilowatts of RF output. I don't think you can do that with standby power. I'll bet you there wasn't any. During a major power outage, I'm guessing most of your broadcast stations go off the air. Is that true, Eric? When you get a chance, Eric?
Some do, some don't. actually up at Empire, we've got generated.
Tell me about that. The generators at Empire, what kind of fuel do they use?
It's a long story. They use diesel fuel. Actually, they have to bring the fuel up by, to bring it up as 55-gallon drums in the elevator.
Wow. Wow. And what's your guess as to the maximum amount of it that can be stored on site?
The fire department allows them to keep 2 weeks' worth of stuff up there.
Yeah, interesting. Do you think the World Trade Center could have gotten permission to use... when you get a chance, Eric, do you think the World Trade Center could have gotten permission to have a standby generator and fuel on, say, the 89th floor?
As far as I know, they didn't, but Cantor Fitzgerald had something besides the battery backup.
What's your guess as to what that could have been?
Well, there was some gasoline-powered, natural gas-powered stuff on the 108th floor, but I'm not sure what it was for.
And you think that had enough fuel to run for a couple of days?
I have no idea, Dick.
Okay. Let's see, who else is going to make a comment? Give me a call with us right now. Okay, we're going to move on. We can always come back to this subject. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, was the next person on our list. And Joe, what would you like to risk tonight? K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
I'd like to know if the TechNet audience or yourself is aware of any kind of power protection units you can put on a house, something like what I brought up last week. Within that subject, but not using a MOV type of technology within something, maybe like a gas discharge tube within something that's resettable and has a little more longevity than the MOV devices apparently do not seem to. Back to you.
Yeah, the first company that I would check on is...
One, two.
Yeah, Eric, I wonder if we should go back to the original exciter, because this one doesn't seem to want to hang in there. I'm having trouble remembering the name of that company in Nevada. I think they're located.
Solar?
No, not Solar. It's a company that makes lightning protection devices.
Polyphaser.
That's the one, polyphaser. Now, if anybody has got the kind of surge protector you're probably looking for, Joe, maybe polyphaser has it. They make some really potent stuff for lightning and surge protection. And so, yeah, MOVs can only take a certain number of joules, a certain number of times, and they get blasted each time, and the material inside gets eaten away. So it's a... I guess it's a kind of protection mechanism if you're willing to change it every 500 miles, if you know what I mean. But you and I would like to buy something that we install at once and forget it. And so, is it high voltage surges that you're worried about in your particular town, the B2RYY, K2RYW?
Well, basically what I'm worrying about is something like what could happen during a high windstorm where you have a high voltage line touching... maybe a secondary line or something like that, and introducing 10 or 20 times the power to that line for maybe, you know, milliseconds until a breaker happens to trip, which is a lot more than a couple of milliseconds. That's the kind of thing I'm worrying about that might possibly happen. And the thing is, if an MOV device only takes so many hits for so long, what happens when it doesn't work? Do you take the hit with all your equipment in your house?
I think the answer is yes. An MOV, my understanding is that there's really an arc that occurs internally and material is being eaten away during that arc. So after a certain number of surge protection events, the MOV either becomes a dead short or an open circuit. I think open circuit is much more likely Once it becomes an open circuit, you no longer protect it. And even if you do have a really beefy overvoltage surge protection device, even if you do have such a device, you've got to worry about what is the impedance between LIPA and you. If you happen to be a really enthusiastic guy and you install double ORC wiring, you know, good for 400 ampere service, 600 ampere service between the pole pig and your house, which now gives you an extremely small source impedance, and you try to put a surge protector on that, no matter what you put there is going to get blasted. So there's more to surge protection than just putting in the right kind of device. You've got to put in the right kind of high impedance device. Maybe it's a series inductor or a known amount of resistance or whatever coming from your, let's say, your main fuse box into the circuit that's being protected that has the surge protector. So that source impedance is something you've got to worry about. If your source impedance is a milliohm, and if that milliohm wants to deliver 400 volts on your 220 line, I don't think any surge protector on planet Earth is going to save you in that particular case. Anyone got any comments on this one? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW. I think we got it, Dick. You think you found it? Even though we just went out?
Yeah, I just did that.
Okay, so you found it, and you're giving us a warranty for what length of time, Eric?
Should be back to normal now.
Okay. Do we care about what it was, or would you rather not say it this time?
Very issue.
All right. So, I wonder if any of the manuals from Polyphaser or similar companies discuss this exact issue. You've got to know the source impedance that you're protecting. And so, you literally want flaky wiring into the circuit that's being protected by a surge protector, an overvoltage protector. And that way you can really accomplish the voltage drop required into the surge protector. And if you've wired your house for 600 ampere service, and if you're directly connected with very low resistance wiring between your computer and that service, I don't think any surge protector is going to help you. Anyone got any comment on this? K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
They do make devices, Dick, that are very, very large. I mean, you can get spark gaps that are very, very large as long as they're used in combination with a circuit breaker or a fuse or something in series with them with the power line that certainly can handle a 200-amp service line. I mean, I've seen them. They're monstrous. Very expensive also. But here again, I think what will happen there is that if you set them close enough to give you true protection, what will really happen is you wind up throwing your main breaker all the time. And you have to keep on resetting it probably like 4 or 5 times a week. And if you size it too large, you won't have the protection that you need. So it's kind of like really you want equipment that can really handle surge and is really designed to do so. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
One more reset, Dick.
Are we back in operation, Eric?
Yeah.
Okay. You guarantee us for the next 2 hours?
Yeah, following, you know, lightning coming and striking it, sure.
Okay, we have a limited warranty from Eric himself, right at the side of the repeater. These great big arcing devices you're describing, Glenn, how often can they take the event? Do they eventually get eaten away? And I think the answer has got to be yes. It looks like you're between a rock and a hard place of setting them sensitive enough but not creating false alarms. Because every power line will have instantaneous spikes. And what's the reset time on one of these arcing devices? If I get a spike that lasts for a millisecond and it protects me during that millisecond, and then it goes back to normal voltage, if the millisecond is not enough to trip the circuit breaker, will the arcing device go back to the resistance mode, or do you have to go back to 0 volts before it goes back to normal operation? On top of that, if you do set it in a sensitive way, so you're tripping a circuit breaker a couple of times per week, you got to worry about the fact that a circuit breaker has a finite number of times that it can break a circuit. There's a ridiculous number of people who, for miserly reasons that using a circuit breaker at the main panel of the house as an on-off switch for turning certain circuits on and off every day. You can't do that because the circuit breaker is not made to be a switch. It's made for a finite number of interruptions under load. And eventually you arc those contacts, they weld together, and you don't have a circuit breaker anymore. It's obvious in comments on all of the above, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, that absolutely is a fact, Dick. I'm not sure if you had the full, you know, comment to what I made before, but basically saying that, yes, these spark gap devices, they're not AMOVs, and when they do conduct, they are a hard, they basically make a hard short, and they are fully resettable when the voltage returns back to 0 volts again. So spark gaps come in some very, very large sizes, but usually they need to be put in series with some kind of impedance to the device, like an MOV for damping. But generally, if they're hard across the line, they'll keep on throwing the breaker, and it'll just become a nuisance after a while. And my final comment was that's really not the right solution. Really, the right solution is to have equipment that's capable of handling surge, which most more modern equipment now is. Although I've been hearing some pretty big horror stories from Andy recently about the television set power supplies he's been seeing explode on him. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
One of the nicest kinds of uninterruptible power is the kind where the line is rectified into a battery charger, and the battery itself is running an inverter that gives you the real power going to your computers and other sensitive equipment. Now, in theory, the computer will never see a surge. That's the good news. But I've been hearing lots of stories during Hurricane Gloria and just before Hurricane Gloria because of the voltage surges that a number of uninterruptible power supplies that power those batteries, the UPS itself was being burned out by the voltage surge. So it's a difficult problem. And from what I understand, from what you just told me, these arcing type voltage, over-voltage protectors, if, for instance, you're using one on a 220 line and it stays conducting even if the line comes back to the 220, that you have to literally make the voltage on the 220 go to zero in order to reset that arcing device. Is that approximately true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Absolutely, Dick. For spark gap devices, that's exactly how it works. The proper application for a spark gap in terms of surge isn't across the power line. A lot of people put them there, and it's really the wrong location. The best actual locations in a circuit for them is across inductors. Many times in a power supply or something running on the power line, there's an EMI filter that has a common mode inductor and or a differential mode inductor on the front end of the supply that's being powered by the power line. And by putting a spark gap device across the inductor, what will happen is during the cycle where there's a voltage beyond the line voltage across the inductor, basically the spark gap conducts at that time, and when the voltage across the inductor returns to zero, it resets and turns back into an inductor again. Very, very nice way of protecting power supplies and input EMI filters by putting the spark gaps across inductors, but certainly not across the power line, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me ask for a couple of details on this one. You said across an inductor, but I think you really mean that the inductor is in series with your protected load, and the spark gap device is across the protected load. So that now, if an overvoltage occurs, the inductor is giving you a real series impedance that's defined. The arcing device, your spark gap, protects you. It makes sure that the voltage doesn't go above, let me pick a number, 240 volts RMS, 250 volts RMS. And now, if the inductor is properly sized, and maybe there's also a shunt capacitor, you tune the inductor for the known load. You choose the inductor for the known load. You've now got a defined impedance back to LIPA, we'll say, and you've got your overvoltage protecting device. In that particular situation, where you've got a clearly defined impedance back to the source by way of the series inductor that was properly sized, I think it's possible to use a pair of very beefy back-to-back Zener diodes. And now automatically they go back into the normal mode when your 240 volt surge, when your surge that went to 270 volts, the back-to-back Zeners protected you, and the inductor took up the difference in voltage When the voltage goes back to the normal 240, your zeners stop conducting, and the only real event that happens now to your protected computer, we'll say, is that during the event he's seeing a waveform that's more square wave. But now the whole thing is a hell of a lot better protected. Does anybody make a device that uses any of the theory that I've just given you, or am I way off base on this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, that type of dampening, or TVS-type dampening, is good for micro-power circuits. When you're dealing with things that are that have basically a known impedance in series with its power supply, and you want to protect it from voltage spikes on low-voltage circuits, that's good, because you can get zener diodes in some fairly decent linear dissipation ranges in the, you know, tens of watts. I mean, I've seen them that will handle linear power dissipation. But on an AC power line, you could never get linear dissipation to withstand those kinds of surges, Dick. Let me let it drop for a second. KC2QIQ.
Aren't there zeners with great big heat sinks, Sir Glenn?
Yes, there is, Dick. And as I said, for DC power, in regulated circumstances, that works. But not on power lines. When you have power lines coming in, the impedance there's no heat sink big enough.
Okay. Could Cantor Fitzgerald, for instance, running, let me pick a number, 100 computers, could they have an individual protection network on each individual computer to protect all 100 computers simultaneously? I think it's a very difficult job to have individual protection circuits on each computer of the kind that you've been describing, which I think could be done with a kind of series inductor, which really is an inline filter, which has a series inductance to it, and some kind of an overvoltage protection device beyond it, which maybe could be a very beefy zener, or maybe these arcing spark gap things. But the spark gap thing is going to trip a circuit breaker locally, and you're going to have to reset it. So I think we're slowly concluding there's no ideal solution here, is there, Glenn? You're going to have a lot of grief. I can tell that Joe is looking for something a lot more robust and a lot more reliable than we've had up till now. And other than have the kind of UPS where you're only charging a battery and the battery's running an inverter, other than that, getting direct protection from overvoltage, and I guess he's also going to want protection from undervoltage, in other words, lack of power, which again means you got a battery and a UPS. There's no glamour fix, is there, right here, Glenn? There's a lot of grief no matter what you do. There's conservation of misery is what I'm hearing. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Very good.
Yeah, Dick, let me have to follow up on that first.
Yeah, we're going to go to Glenn and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
There's a misunderstanding here. On Class 1 circuits, you have a line, a neutral, and the safety earth or ground connection. What most people think is that when there's a surge that comes in and destroys your power equipment, that it's line to neutral that's destroying your equipment, and that by putting a overvoltage device there is going to protect it. That's not the fix. You'll never save anything like that. Let me let it drop for a second. The majority of power surges that destroy electrical equipment is actually either line to chassis or line to protective earth or neutral to protective earth. More commonly line, because usually somewhere in a power system, the line and the neutral and the ground are usually tied together somewhere back either at the utility or back in your fuse box or your fuse or circuit breaker panel. But the line is a high-floating circuit, and usually if you look at the voltages in the surge situation between line to neutral, you'll get some maybe 120-150% overvoltages, but nothing compared to the amount of overvoltages that you'll see between the line and the chassis. Those are the ones that need to be protected, because that's where all the major breakdowns take place. The solution there is spark gaps that are across your inductors, and basically create enough spacing between your line to the chassis or the protective earth connections to protect your Class 1 circuits. And yes, you can protect easily up to 6 kV. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When you say a spark gap across an inductor, I don't think you really mean it's shunting the inductor itself.
Yes, I do.
I was hoping that you were saying that the inductor is in series and the shunt is after that, the spark gap. if you shunt the inductor itself, and therefore you're shorting out the inductor, do you still have an inductor?
At the moment of surge, where that voltage exceeds the rating, in other words, you can put like a kilovolt spark gap across an inductor. So if you get a kickback between, let's say, the inductors in series with the line, and the surge is taking place between the line and the chassis or neutral during that particular moment, and you get a huge voltage breakup, the spark gap will shunt the inductor at that point, so the inductor will not ring and fire back another kilovolt or greater surge back into the electronic equipment, at which time the surge dissipates again, the current through the inductor, because it's on the AC power line, crosses zero, and it clears itself and it continues to work as an inductor again. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, and the series inductor you're talking about is part of a line filter that the plug that enters the chassis of the piece of equipment?
Absolutely. Most electronic equipment today, if you look at them, there is some kind of an EMI filter that's usually for high frequency, usually to meet conducted emissions somewhere between 150 kilohertz of bandwidth to about 30 megahertz. And in that area, you're going to probably need about 40 dB of attenuation, and that's done with X capacitors across the power line that have to be UL rated. You're going to have your common mode inductor in the front, basically that takes care of the inductance to the potential earth or ground, and then you have your differential inductor that's inside there. And across those inductors, it's a very good idea to have spark gaps. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, I'm hearing there's a whole art and science to this. And when it comes to the surge protection that you need for the 50,000 volt amperes or even higher numbers that you run in your broadcast transmitters, how in the world do you do that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. I was going to say that Glenn really got it right. First of all, if you're running 100 computers, then yeah, you should be running a UPS or a device that we use for tech power. But for the transmitters, now the transmitter will take like 400 or 500% over voltage and it won't really care. But what we do with the transmitter is a little different. We got this gizmo called an isobar, and that takes care of the 50 kilovolt peaks, anything less than that. And shunted across the isobars themselves is an arc gap. And the arc gap is actually gas filled. I don't remember exactly what the voltage is. I think the voltage is somewhere around 500 or 600 volts per 277 volt leg, because, you know, the transmitters run on 480. And basically it acts as a shunt and a voltage regulator, if you think about it. And then past that, it's kind of mandatory to have a voltage regulator, because if I run my digital transmitter without it, as LIPA goes up and down, my output goes up and down, so we manage that. As far as we run 500 or 600 desktops to the city, there's a large UPS with another set of isobars feeding the UPS. The UPS also has its own set of arc gaps and a harmonic filter at the input. But as far as the computers are concerned, they don't see anything because they're getting their results, their AC from the DC that's being generated, and the battery's kind of smooth it out, if you want to call it that. The batteries are always in line. They're constantly being charged. There's a whole lot of circuitry there that measure the internal resistance of the battery as it goes along. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, Eric, I think you've switched which transmitter you're using now, probably the one from your automobile, and that particular transmitter is about 6 or 8 dB hot in audio. I'm amazed that you are not chopping out of the machine. You didn't at all. You held the machine beautifully, but that audio was very hot, and some of your speech became square waves. good speech. When it comes to methods of overvoltage protection, methods and brand names, do you have a favorite brand name that you like in your particular industry, Eric? Maybe that would help Joe. I'm picturing myself sitting in Joe's shoes right now. He's hearing a lot of information, but he doesn't have... he can't go out whistling that tune, if you know what I mean. We haven't given him a very complete package of an answer. So is there a brand name that you believe he should start looking at? K2EJ with a little less audio, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm sorry, Dick. You're always complaining that I'm too low. That's why I was greeting him like this. Sorry. I missed the part of what is he trying to protect? A computer, a series of computers, 100 computers, what?
I don't think he's really defined what. He knows that he locally gets some really high spikes of voltage and sometimes significant periods of high voltage, and he wants to protect from that. But let me pass it over to Joe Casey. He can tell us exactly what he's trying to protect. Maybe that makes a difference. From E2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, first of all, I did not say anything about knowing I'm getting a voltage surge. I don't know I'm getting a voltage surge. I would imagine during a windstorm, if you have trees arcing across, trees moving across wires, you have a chance of having a branch touch a high voltage line and maybe possibly give you a conduction to a secondary wire, wiring underneath it, or something like that, where we have a case of 69 kV touching maybe 7800 volt line or something like that. Something where it's going to deliver the end result, where it's going to deliver you a much higher voltage to your house than you really desire. That's the thing I'm really talking about. Something about you not sitting there on a piece of equipment looking at these spikes coming in, but what I'm looking for is something that might be available to be used in commercial. A commercially made product, but has what can be used in a residence that you can put at your power behind after your power meter in your house to protect your whole, to be able to protect your entire house at once without putting surge arrests on everything, because surge arrests seem to have a finite life the way they basically are constructed. Back to you, Dick.
I have some answers.
KC2MDP.
Eric and Steve in that order. Go ahead, Eric. And Eric, do you have a particular brand name you would recommend for this kind of protection that Steve is talking about, that Joe is talking about? You got it, Eric.
All right, there's a number of ways to go. It really depends upon how much service you're providing the house with. If it's a typical 60-amp thing, I would recommend one thing. If it's 100-amp to 200-amp, then I'd recommend another thing. You have to reach into your pocket a little bit. If you're doing a 60-amp thing, 220 volt, two single-phase lines coming into the house, a company called Solar Basic, they make a really wonderful auto transformer that, deals with about 20% of the variation of the load line. As far as over voltage goes and under voltage goes, within that 20% range, you're doing good. You don't have to spend a lot of money to see somewhere in the range of, 400 to 700 or 800 bucks. If you're going to go bigger and you want to really deal with what's coming in, and then you're going to have to reach into your pocket a little more there, I would recommend a spike protector like Isobars. There's a couple of companies that make, actually Isobars are Solar Basic trademark. There's a couple of variations of it. That box for, say, 100 amps is probably around $400 or $500. And then, after that, you'd really want a couple other companies. Solar Basic makes some more. They make bigger versions of them. What they basically are variants with motors on them and a little intelligent controller. How much overkill you want is how deep is your pocket. K2RIW, K2JX.
Very fine, Eric. Lots of very specific information in there. Real brand name. But you're going to have to reach into your pocket. Steve, I believe you work in electrical wiring. How do those guys in Baldwin protect themselves from the things that Joe was talking about? KC2MDP, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, what I do here is I use a lot of surge suppressors. I got surge suppressors connected to surge suppressors connected to surge suppressors. But they do make an arc fault breaker. Now, this has come out several years ago. They recalled them because there were problems with them. They reissued them. It's now the code. And basically what this arc fault breaker is designed to do is if you have an electrical arc, basically from like a defective outlet or something, loose wiring, and you get an arc in that circuit, it'll trip the circuit breaker. Now, I looked up the information on these things, and it's kind of vague. They do give you a block diagram. They really don't give you any specifics on this thing. But according to the diagram, it is voltage sensitive. Now, they don't tell you
what voltage is voltage sensitive at. You know, if it's 120 volt breaker, they don't tell you what the trip voltage is. So that might be another idea to look into. And I know these things, they're not that expensive. They're probably around, you know, $35, $40 range. Back to you, Dick.
Protect you from big spikes.
Yeah. Where would I buy that if I wanted to, Steve?
Oh, any electrical supply you'll have them. Unfortunately, right now, they're only coming 15 and 20 amps. You can get them in single pole or two pole. And, like I said, electrical supply house will carry them. I think most of the home stores will carry them. You know, the big orange store, I'm sure they'll have them. Back to you.
And, Eric, do you want to slowly repeat what you said? Because it sounds like you're a little worried about these things. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
I've delved into them quite a lot because I put in a whole bunch of GFCI breakers, which basically those breakers, because I have some stuff that deals with water and things like that, they kind of, what they do is you take the neutral line. The breaker actually has two lines going to it. One is you feed the neutral to it, you feed the hot lead to it, and the ground is independent. What it does is it senses more than 20 milliamps of juice happening on the neutral line, it'll pop it. It's basically a little IC in there that monitors a little chunk wire across the neutral line that feeds the breaker. The aux suppression breakers are now the code. They look for a rapid transient peak. You would think that would actually fire off on a line voltage variation, but it doesn't. It requires something like a slew rate that's pretty fast, and when you get an arc, just sort of like if you think of a Tesla coil or anything like that, where the current actually goes through a little inductor, and if you have a high rise time change, there's an op-amp in there that actually measures that and then trips the breaker. So you get the idea.
I think I do. Now, in order to be code, every outlet, particularly in a bathroom and a kitchen, but probably any outlet, certainly that's at the outside wall of the house, should, I think it absolutely has to be, ground fault interrupter, GFI protected. And the way a GFI device works is it really looks at the amount of current flowing out of the hot line and back into the neutral or return, make sure that there's a balance, and if you, the external hand and foot standing in water or touching the hot line, you imbalance the circuit, it senses something like 10 milliamps, I'm going to say, of imbalance, and it trips. And in order for it to trip, the house side of the GFI is continuously getting power from LIPA. The load side outside the house is getting the imbalance, and as such, the GFI is capable of carrying through to latch when it senses an imbalance, because the input side of it is continuously being powered. However, if you're now taking a GFI circuit and backfeeding it, because you've had a power failure and you've got a generator in the backyard, and you're one of these foolish, quick and dirty guys that feeds the outlet out of the house, out of the GFI, in the reverse direction, it's my belief that you may not have complete protection of GFI anymore. That because the other side is being powered, the latching circuit might not have carry through. I wonder if you have an opinion on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
No, that was an interesting thing, actually, when I did that. One of the GFI breakers tripped, and there was nothing connected to it, so I would assume that what you're saying is absolutely correct, because it's got to come from the source side, and with the generator, there's definitely an imbalance between the ground and the neutral side, so I wasn't feeding it through a GFI breaker, it just wasn't happening at all.
Yeah, well, we've got a generator running in the backyard, and you should never, never run a generator in the house. You don't want to spill a cup of gasoline on the floor and lift the roof off the house. You don't want carbon monoxide in the house. You don't want the noise in the house. Your generator is definitely an outside item, not even to be run in the garage. It's really outdoors in the backyard. When you've got a backyard generator sitting on the lawn, and now between a rock and a hard place, do you ground it? Yeah, for human protection, when you touch the metal of the generator, having a local ground on it is a safe thing to do. But now the difference between the ground of the generator outdoors and the grounding of the fuse panel inside the house and the GFI that's in between, you could, by way of your grounding of the generator, not floating it, you could be creating an imbalance that trips the GFI, and therefore your ability to backfeed that circuit, that connector on the output wall of the house, might be compromised. Got an opinion on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ in the comments.
Eric first, then Glenn. You got it, Eric.
Guys, just to make matters straight here, I actually grounded the generator to the same point which the electrical box is grounded, a nice grounding rod. I used a pretty heavy gauge wire, a number 8 gauge wire between the generator's ground and the ground. And it fed the top of the inside of the box, which is right after the main breaker. So, I wouldn't call it a balanced thing. As far as the GFI breaker is concerned, it would see juice on the input side, and it would see load on the output side. Again, there was nothing connected to one of them, and it tripped. Whether that was just incidental and I banged into it, or it actually tripped, I don't know, but that was just my observation. So, but I would be concerned that if you're using a generator without a ground, that's probably a bad thing. And I wouldn't feed a GFI socket either with the generator. You really want to go... you want to do like a transfer switch where you hit the main bus of the fuse box.
Yeah, without a doubt, the transfer switch is the right approach. But I think nowadays, a transfer switch is like $350, and it's something you're going to use once per 10 years. So it's a little bit difficult to justify it. How did you solve the problem, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, just the first thing I wanted to say, Dick, is that, driving a ground rod in the ground or finding a local earth ground for a generator isn't much protection at all. The ground that's important is that you have to be on the neutral ground point of the house. If you're attaching the generator directly to the house, that's the ground you want to be attached to. Now, I connect the generator here basically is I have an outlet connection on the outside of the house where basically it's a high-powered, like Hubble-style connector, sexless, so I can actually attach my generator without exposed pins and have non-exposed pins on the house when I plug it in. And I have to also make sure that I shut off the main breaker because I don't have an auto transfer switch. So I shut off the main breaker on the service box, basically turn on my generator, and I can basically power my house. But there again, the ground on that generator through the cable is actually connected right to the house ground right at the panel deck. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
That's exactly what I did.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to go if and only if you wire that cable correctly. If each of those three pins of that connector were displaced by 120 degrees, you could have a hot generator, which is floating on a concrete pad, if you know what I mean. A smart person would do some ohm meter checks before he turns on the generator, but do you see what I'm worrying about here when do-it-yourself people do this kind of wiring? Over to you, Glenn, KQRIW.
My advice there, Dick, is that if somebody is really not sure of how to connect a generator to their house, call an electrician. Get somebody in that definitely knows for sure. Because it's not something you really want to play with, because your life, your house, your property is all in jeopardy here. So this is not an area where you want to play around. I would suggest that this is one area that if you know what you're doing, it's really not that difficult to do. If you're not sure, definitely call an electrician. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, good advice. There's another question I was going to ask along these lines. Can't think of it right now. I know we didn't give you a complete answer, Joe, but at least you got a little bit more information, and it ain't easy. So B2RYY for a final, K2RYW.
I look at it like this, Dick. if I ask the question each week, eventually I'll get enough answers, and it'll all start making some sense. No, really, seriously, no, I appreciate the people that are checking in and they come out with things like the suggestion Eric had about the isobars. That seems to be a direction I'll probably start doing some research on, because I want something that's resettable, that's not going to have a limited life or a unprojectable type of life, as far as, you know, you think it's rated for 10 years and has a warranty for 10 years, but really it's only good for 2 years. I'm really looking for something that's probably more with more reliability behind it. K2RW, W2RYY.
One quick comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I know we scratched on the surface of this one a little bit, but something that people should be really kind of mindful of, because most surges that do take place in the house that destroy electrical equipment, computers, TVs, ham radios, etc., really is a surge between one of either the line neutral and the safety ground, or basically that's called class one wiring. You know, it's line neutral and that third pin on the bottom, class one, very important thing to memorize. And in that kind of wiring scheme, a ground fault interrupter socket or outlet right at that point basically is going to give you a lot of protection, because if you have a surge, you're going to generate more than 2 milliamps through the ground pin. And so a lot of times, and it's relatively a fast release on those outlets, so you get a lot of protection if you've got electronic equipment and you don't have a ground fault interrupting socket on your sensitive equipment. Put one there. I think you'd be very surprised at how much additional protection that would give you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And also, they make 200 amp GFI breakers, so you could actually put that on your entire house.
Wow. A 100 or 200 amp GFI on the whole main, fuse panel. Do they make a 220 version of that, Eric? And does it still have 20 or 2 milliamperes of sensitivity at the 200 ampere level? Over to you, Eric.
Well, just to let you know, we're in the process now at this station of making a change, and the new code requirement is a 600 amp GFI breaker, so that should give you an idea.
And one other crazy question. If I wanted to wire a socket for the outside of my house that is capable of running 220 machinery, like maybe I've got a 220 volt compressor, is there a 220 volt GFI that would be appropriate? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, there are, and they're not cheap.
And I think it's a waste of money, Dick.
Yes, give me a couple words on that, Eric. I mean that, Glenn.
On most 220 powered equipment, the key thing that you really want to have there is you want something that will really source the surge and the power. I think at that point in time, because you're not generally talking about a piece of very, very sensitive electronic equipment. You're talking about either something like a powerful thing like an air conditioner or a stove, something relatively high power. The key thing to that outlet that you're going to run there is you want to make sure that you've got a neutral and ground connection that is very, very well bonded with the lowest impedance wire you can have going back. That's really what you're looking for. To have ground fault interruption on a piece of heavy equipment like that, I think it's just going to be more of a nuisance than a real protection device for your equipment. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, I've got to make one comment.
Yeah, I've got a comment on this one also. Go ahead, Eric, first.
The purpose of a GFI-type device is not to protect your equipment, it's to protect the human being. So if you're running a lathe that's in a shop and it's ground, and it all of a sudden becomes hot, you don't want to become part of the circuit.
Yeah, but I just said there that your ground and your neutral are very, very tightly bonded. That's what's key, because there again, you want to make sure that your ground and your neutral are really there, because this way, no matter what happens to your line, when it hits that ground or neutral, it's going to snap that breaker and it's going to go wide open before anybody can get electrocuted.
Agreed. And that's the requirement for any GFI breaker.
Okay, there's two ways of looking at this. Either an imbalanced current that flows onto the third wire. If I'm running a 220 external circuit, like a high-power compressor in the backyard, which really means the red lead from LIPA and the black lead from LIPA, which has 240 volts across them, that's really feeding my high-power compressor. And the neutral and grounding wire That's there for protection of the case of the compressor. But if now me, the human being, makes the mistake of touching black wires to earth, in other words, my feet are on wet lawn, and I touch the black wire with my finger, or I touch the red wire with my finger, I've now created an imbalance current flowing through me to earth, and the GFI sensing that current and tripping could keep me alive. So I think I agree with Eric on this one. The GFI, a 220-volt GFI running a piece of heavy equipment in the backyard, it's not protecting the equipment per se, it's protecting the human being. Do you see where I'm going on that one, Eric? Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
I understand the theory of what you're saying there, Dick, but I wouldn't count on it, not for a minute. If you think that the GFI at a 2 milliamp limit is going to save your life, if you were to touch one of the high signs and then you're touching the chassis or earth ground, and you think that that's going to protect you, I think you'd be really, really surprised. That GFI is probably going to stay right on. I wouldn't count on that thing opening. I would suggest that you got to make sure that whenever you make these kinds of 220 connections that you've got enough insulation there and everything's boxed in really, really well so that you can't touch it, because I would not want to count on a GFI snapping if I were touching the 220 and I was holding either the chassis ground or a loose earth ground someplace. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I got another one, Dick.
You got it, Eric.
I have these little devices that actually have 2 megaohm resistors, and they actually take one side of the line and takes it to the ground. You push a little button on them. I've got one for 120 volts. I've got one for 240 or 220. And I've got another one for 480. And what it does is it puts the resistor across any of the lines to ground. When you hit that button, if that breaker don't pop, you've got a wiring problem.
I think I agree with you on this one, Eric. Yes, without a doubt, a person should definitely wire this heavy piece of machinery in the backyard in such a way that everything is protected. There's no exposed wiring. The right kind of cases, the right kind of breakout boxes and whatever are all there so that the human being can't touch it. But in the worst case, somebody is poking his finger inside of a machine. He doesn't realize it's live. And he touches black wire with reference to earth. His feet are on earth, and his finger is touching the black wire. And he's conducting, let me pick a number, 5 milliamperes of current. I'd like to believe that 5 milliamps can be sensed, of imbalance, can be sensed by the GFI, and it trips and turns off that whole 220 circuit, and I continue to live. Does that sound reasonable to you, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RWK3J. Now, the breakers that I put in there rated at resistor current of 20 milliamps quite a significant trip, which is a bit much for a human being, but, you know, it just still gives you some room. The reality is, those things, if you have a device, and let's say the case is one side of the hotline, that means there's going to be some juice flowing on the ground. The breakers should trip when you get that fault in the device. If you happen to be in a bathroom and you're using a razor blade and one side of the line shorts out because it doesn't necessarily have a ground connection, at 20 milliamps worth of current draw there of imbalance, the breaker should trip and you therefore should live. So, yeah, I'm agreeing with it.
Now, it is my belief that a 220-volt circuit breaker is looking for a balance of current between red and black. Now, if the red current is 20 milliamps higher than the black current, and the piece of electronics itself, it might be a simple heating coil of some kind, which is floating between the red and black, and it doesn't make, and the heating coil itself makes no contact to neutral. It floats. But any imbalance between red current and black current, because my finger is touching red wire and my feet are touching ground, that particular connection that I've created doesn't necessarily create current flowing on the third wire of that circuit to that GFI. It only creates an imbalance between black and red. And I'm hoping that that GFI can detect that, and if so, it can protect me. Am I off base on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
KC2MDP. That's it. You can't count on it.
Now, Steve recognized, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, let me put it to you this way. I'm not as familiar with the 220 devices. I just know that they're there and that the ones that you put in have a little wire that connects to the neutral bus at the box. I do know that the 120 devices have both the hot and the neutral connected to them. And the ground is independent. So, yeah, I'm agreeing with what you're saying. As far as, like, Glenn saying, don't count on it, I would disagree to the point of that whatever the rated value of that GFI breaker is, when you exceed that, it should trip. And you're right about 220. When you're going between the red wire and the black wire. But in essence, you don't need a neutral. I mean, that's not part of the circuit, really. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so that particular GFI would protect my life of the one that I described. But now I've got another problem. Some of the 220 equipment I might run in the backyard might not be a balanced load on A circuit and B circuit. In other words, I might be running a pair of computers, heavy-duty computers, we'll say. And the computer that's running on 120 volts on the red line draws 10 amperes, and the computer that's running 5 amperes on the black line in other words, my load itself might not be a balanced 220 load. So now, how in the world can a circuit breaker not be false alarming in that particular situation? And maybe I can't really do that. Let's see what Steve has to say on all this. KC2MDP, K2RIW.
That's a split device, and there's breakers for that, too.
So in other words, I really would take two individual GFIs, is what I think you're saying. Steve, you got it.
Yeah, they're paired together.
Okay, Dick, I sort of got the picture of where you guys are coming from. Okay, 240 volt GFI, it will not basically, it doesn't sense from hot leg A to hot leg B. You need the neutral. If you were to take the neutral off the GFI breaker inside the panel, which it needs, it would just be a regular circuit breaker. It wouldn't do anything. As far as two GFIs for a 240 volt circuit, that will not work either, because now you're creating an imbalance between A and B, and now you got to remember you have two neutrals connected to your panel. And number three, as far as the GFI tripping when you touch that hot wire to ground, well, all I can say is basically don't count on it, because I've encountered several times where I could stand on wet ground and get railed off a hot leg from a GFI, and the thing never tripped. So that's my story. Back to you, Dick.
That sounds effective.
Hold on now, Steve. On that GFI that didn't trip, where you got railed, as you said, was that a 120 circuit or a 240 circuit? Steve, go ahead.
Oh, I've gotten hit off both. And the GFI is not defective. It's basically I'm just not conducting enough current to trip the GFI.
What is the recommended current at which a GFI should trip, Steve?
To be quite honest with you, Dick, I don't remember. I mean, I could look it up. I could go into work, open up one, and read the literature and find out. But it's something really small. It might be 20 milliamps or something. It's something ridiculously small. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm guessing it's something like 2 to 20 milliamperes. In the old days when we used to take the ham radio test, 200 milliamps was considered a lethal amount of current flowing through a human being. Of course, there's a huge number of variables here. What part of the human being is it flowing through and so on. So I'd like to believe that GFIs trip somewhere in the vicinity of 2 to 20 milliamperes. There's at least a 10 to 1, maybe a 100 to 1 safety factor. But are you getting complete protection from a GFI in all these circumstances? I'm not so sure. It's certainly better than nothing, but I can see circumstances in which it might not give you protection. Anybody have any further comments on this? Give me a call. It is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2MDP for a quick one.
You got it, Steve.
Here's a little test you can do. Take a 100-watt bulb, stick it in like a pigtail socket. Basically, it's just a socket with two leads. Stick one end of it in your in the hot leg of your GFI, then take the other end of it and stick it into the ground of the GFI. You'll see that bulb light up
briefly before that GFI trips. Back to you.
So there's some number of milliseconds for it to trip. And that makes some sense, because otherwise it would be false alarming like crazy. And I think you're saying